This podcast is brought to you with support from The Big Idea, New Zealand's online hub for creative people. The Big Idea aims to support talented, innovative individuals and organisations and advocates for creativity as an essential ingredient in the cultural and economic wealth of New Zealand. Their website is thebigidea.nz. This is Don't Give Up Your Day Job. I'm jumping right in. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. My name's Bobby, by the way.
And you so, are? Who cares?
I care. You care. Everyone cares.
Right. Okay.
Everyone is listening. Obviously, they wouldn't be here otherwise.
Maybe they're just here for the guest, and they don't give a shit
and
who we are.
And our guest being today, I like to call him a world-famous DJ, Gene Rivers. Have you ever been to a live DJ show?
No.
Right. And what does the term DJ evoke to you when you hear it? What is it?
I feel like you're setting me up.
No?
What does it mean to me?
I don't need to set you up. You'll fall in your own traps.
What does it mean to... I don't know. I don't really have much of a concept.
When I say, hey Danny, let's go and see it. If I was to say, let's go and watch a DJ show, what would be the first thing that would pop in your mind? Like, oh, nah, not into that crap, or...
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, DJ, of course, the actual term DJ, I think of a disc jockey, of a radio disc jockey. But if you're talking about going to like a DJ show, I think of clubs.
Yeah.
And I mean, I remember when clubbing became a thing in the 90s, I was still a teenager. And but to me, it was like the opposite of band life, you know. And I went clubbing, I think, twice with a group of friends and a girl I liked.
Right.
And like, I remember standing there just watching all these fucking morons dancing really weird, listening to this horrible music.
Yeah.
And just going, what the fuck? And I remember one particular night, we were halfway into the evening. And
was this a rave? You went to a rave?
I don't know what I went. No, I think it was just a club in town somewhere.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I just halfway through the evening and I was just like, this is bullshit. And I just went, fuck you guys, and left.
Right.
Went home.
What was it about it that was bullshit? Just the...
It just, well, I mean...
The loud...
I was more judgmental than I am now.
How is that possible?
But for me, it just wasn't for me.
Right.
You know, the music was... It was the height of the kind of techno unzi thing.
Right.
And to me, it wasn't really music because it was just so repetitive.
Yeah.
And it wasn't dynamic or it wasn't going anywhere. It wasn't music. To me, it facilitated what everyone else was there for, which was, you know, to pop pills and dance and try and pick each other up.
Right. Which is not what you were there for. You didn't do any of that.
No. Because I wasn't, quite honestly, I wasn't into that scene. I've always been strangely into music, which I know is very odd, you know.
Yeah.
For musicians, we're supposed to be all about the other stuff, but I actually fucking liked music.
Yeah, some of the biggest music stars in the world these days are DJs. You know, like there are people. Is it Dave? Oh, what's his name? Guerra or whatever. I don't even remember the name of the. But
it's a loose term, though. I think
a million people on a beach in Rio de Janeiro.
When I was talking about in clubbing, DJs were really just standing there playing CDs and then dancing around with their headphones on. I mean,
right.
It was bullshit.
So it wasn't much of a show then?
Not really. And because I carried on in my life as a musician, I never really looked back at it, you know?
Yeah.
So, but I think the term DJ now has evolved. I think it's a very different thing.
Right, because there's a lot more, musicality, if you could use that
I think
term.
So. I think I definitely think so. I mean, look, we talked to Yokozuna and they basically have a strong DJ element to their band, but they are a band.
Right. You mean like as in terms of their electronic dance music kind of...
and using samples and mixing the electronic and the live.
Yeah, and that takes skill, doesn't it?
Of course it does,
I mean, I've talked to Gene about this a few times whenever we've spoken about that culture, because I don't know much about it, the dance sort of EDM culture.
Yeah. Are you more in line with my experience, or do you have a
I've never been to a rave in my life.
Right.
But I know the peak time you're talking about, because I was working in a music store. Not only that, I was working in a music store in central Auckland where a lot of people would come and buy electronic dance music, the latest thing, and there'd be volumes after volumes after volumes of new...
nonsense.
Yeah, and they're all sort of within... And I could, and I think we mentioned it in the podcast. I can't remember; it was a wee while since we recorded it. But about the different types, like handbag, house, and trance,
right?
And downbeat and all that sort of stuff. And I didn't really understand the differences because to me it sounded kind of the same. But
yeah,
it all comes down to the tempo, you know.
It's like genre and subgenre names and all the various types of metal and so on.
Yeah, but what I was mentioning about talking to Gene was that DJs are very reticent about considering themselves or describing themselves as musicians.
Yeah,
as such. But I don't know. I'm pretty sure in a way that they could, not in the traditional term, but they use music as a way to engage people and get them to enjoy the show or whatever, you know. Mm.
It's an interesting debate. The credibility of an art or of an art form.
Yeah,
it's an interesting debate. I mean, you've got people who are very skilled at painting in a real life way. You know, the painting ends up looking like a photo, and it's amazing. Mm. Then you've got someone else who does some really abstract shit, and you look at it and think, well, you know, anyone could do that.
Mm.
So, which is more credible? And it's a really difficult one. You know, I mean, the DJ versus the musician thing. The first thing that comes to my mind is the years and years and years and years and years of learning and furthering an instrument.
Mm.
You just can't ignore that.
Yeah.
And yes, it takes creativity and skill to be a DJ, of course. But you can't say it takes the same as someone studying an instrument for 15 years.
No, but on the other hand, you could say that some DJs, and I know in particular the one we've got as a guest today, DJ Gene Rivers, he spent years and years and years listening to music. And not just...
So do musicians, though.
But not just hearing music, listening to it and finding the you know, what piece of music would flow into the next one and work well, and how to get a crowd going. And he's quite staunch in the way that he approaches putting a set together, you know, for instance.
Sure. But everything you've said just describes musicians too.
Yeah, sure.
And it's not about...
I wasn't trying to put a dichotomy on either one of them.
Sure. Yeah. And I think that's the point, is that it's not a competition.
Yeah.
You know, and it shouldn't be a competition. You know, we all have different ways of getting to what we're doing.
Yeah,
I mean, you can have the same argument within music, the musician culture too.
Mm.
You know, a classical piano player who can play all this intense stuff versus a bass player in a punk band.
Right, he plays four notes to the bar. And
what's more credible? And it's too murky.
And I don't think anyone should feel they have the right to say what's more credible than...
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not a competition.
Yeah, yeah.
It all has its level of importance. And then you've got the misinterpretation of complexity. For example, there are a lot of people out there who are under the impression that the Beatles music is very easy to play, which it actually isn't.
Mm.
People who think that Ringo was a shit drummer, and he was extraordinary, you know. And anyone who's really learnt to play the Beatles music...
Yeah.
You end up just, the more you dissect it, the more you find its brilliance and it's beautifully crafted.
Right, yeah.
You know,
it's complexity but simplicity all wrapped in one kind of, yeah.
But all these things float around, all these weird rumors and opinions fly around about how it's simple and it's this and it's that. And
yeah, everyone's going to have an opinion, I suppose. And what, those people who tend to be pariahs a little bit. And sometimes some of those DJs don't help themselves. You know, you'll see photos on the internet, memes that go around of a DJ, definitely sitting there listening with one headphone on and the other fiddling and twiddling knobs, but then you'll see the rest at the back of his desk. It's not plugged in.
Right.
You know, so literally they're playing a laptop. They've got the laptop playing. So those guys don't do themselves any favours, you know.
No.
But then there are those guys who are just really great at controlling a crowd or knowing what to play and how to mix these things in. And still more, I've seen a few things around now. I don't know if this is a new phenomenon, but there are some really great drummers out there who are doing live DJ stuff in the way of they're triggering things with electronic drums.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they're playing, you know, to backing tracks, for lack of a better term.
Right.
But actually crafting and molding a song as they go along by triggering certain things and playing certain things.
And this is the thing, is when I was quite young and I had all these sort of big opinions about this stuff, this is good and this isn't good and whatever, what kept screwing me up was that then artists I liked would do things that I thought wasn't cool.
Right.
And I'm like, well, wait a minute. Where does that put me?
Yeah, yeah, it makes you question your whole existence.
Yeah, and so I guess that's why I dropped the whole argument, and I now take things more on an individual basis. You know, do I like the piece of work? Is it saying something to me?
Yep.
it doesn't really matter whether I consider it to be
exactly, you know, man. You know, the art is the thing that you should be judging,
right?
You know, does it do it? And but only judging how I think it affects you as a person, which is that's an interesting conversation we can get into, and we want to at some point talk to someone who is a music critic, you know, about how they.
We have someone in mind.
Yes, so that will be cool if we ever get around to doing that. But this guy, as I say, Gene Rivers, he had a show on Georgia FM for a while, and it was had a really big following. So let's jump in, and have a listen to what he has to say. He's got some opinions about a few things.
Good, we like that.
Yeah.
Now let's do this.
I did see somewhere on line the other day, Danny, that you're a fan of Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
What?
Yeah, someone asked you a question about if you were a movie character or if you were in a movie, what's your favourite movie or some shit? And you would think, probably because I've just watched it and I really love it, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
This must be a really old...
I don't know where it was and I don't know why I was looking at it. It came up.
Well, I'm not involved in this conversation.
But you answered the question.
I know, but I might have answered that question 10 years ago.
Right.
It might be some historic...
So you don't like that movie then?
I love that movie. But right. I don't have no memory of the interview, that's what I'm saying.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
What was it for? It was Graham Reed, I think.
Oh, yeah.
It was a Graham Reed interview.
Yeah. Oh, that was years ago.
Right. Yeah. So, Gene, welcome along.
Thank you, Bobby. Lovely to be here.
Your style of music is really different from the world that Danny and I come from.
Sure.
So maybe just talk a little bit about your background. How did you, growing up, because your dad is one of the original members of...
He was a member of the Kiwis, one of the Māori show bands. My uncle was a sax player with the Quintikis. And so I was raised in and around that show band environment.
Right.
Lugging my dad's bass and amps to gigs for him and so forth, going to practices, and a lot of family bands was basically what I was raised around.
Yep.
Musically, that was, I guess, my first introduction to music. So we would always have guitars and pianos and drums and always set up around the house, and so that was my, I guess, my introduction to music. And a bit of a background myself as to where I went with music, I suppose, is back to your question. Mm.
You don't have to go back to it. You can just ramble on.
I could ramble on, couldn't I?
I can't even remember what it was. What was it?
It's easier for us if you just ramble. We don't have to say anything.
I was hoping you guys would lead the boat by questions. But as you mentioned, different style of music to yourself. But I, being raised around show bands and band practices and whatnot, music was always a huge thing. But I guess I was a product of, one, the environment I grew up within my family, and two, the environment I grew up with in my neighbourhood, which was in Mangere, South Auckland, in the late 70s, early 80s.
Right.
And the influence of hip hop culture, and how that took me on my own journey with music. So one, the family influences; two, the environment and the neighborhood I grew up
in. When did hip hop come to Auckland, to New Zealand? But it's settled in that sort of South Auckland, or grew and seeded in that area. But when did it sort of hit our shores?
Well, my earliest recollection was watching the Tuesday documentary, and I had no idea of the name of the Tuesday documentary at the time, and it was just by fluke that I was allowed to be up, because I think they aired at 8:30 and I was normally in bed by 8.
Right.
But anyway, I was watching Tuesday documentary, and it later found out it was Style Wars, the documentary.
Oh, okay.
Which was about the history of New York graffiti.
Right.
Or the origins of New York graffiti.
Yeah.
And that whole subculture of breakdancing and DJing. And it was beyond, it didn't have a name in terms of it being hip hop. Well, I certainly didn't. There was no. It was like, well, what is this? You know, this looks really cool.
You're talking early 80s-ish or mid 80s?
Yeah, very early 80s.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was still a couple of years into primary school at the time.
It was pretty, I mean, it was still relatively new in the States too.
Yeah. My understanding that early 70s.
Yeah. I think the beginnings were DNA, and then it sort of evolved over that sort of next decade.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so by the time it filtered down to New Zealand...
Did it come from beat poetry, or what was the...
No, my understanding was that it came from a Jamaican DJ by the name of Cool Herc, and he was the first guy to go... back to back on the turntables, like taking that four bar break and having two turntables and backtracking one and then controlling a manual loop using two records, and then speaking over top of it, because again, this is my understanding that the DJing in Jamaica was the guy that was talking, not so much the guy that was playing the records, that was the selector.
Right.
So apparently, so he brought that to the block parties, and then that gave rise to the dance culture and then the graffiti art that spawned from it and so forth. And and that was hugely influential watching that Tuesday documentary. I remember going to school the next day, I was like, holy shit, what did I just see? Shortly after that, saw Beat Street.
Yeah, I remember. So that would have been 83, 84 maybe.
Yeah.
So Beat Street was a big thing when I was at school too. And in Christchurch, I remember it, breakdancing had hit the town square, city, literally the square in Christchurch. And they'd put down cardboard. And then you'd have one. There was one guy who had been to New York and he'd learned some moves. And he was this amazing, everyone loved him. His name was Silver. And he would do all of these great moves, and everyone would just be in awe. And then the kids would come around and try and learn the dances.
Wow.
And it was all around Beat Street, you know. Yep. But there was another, what was the other film?
Breakdance came out.
Breakdance, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. It was Buffalo Girls Around the Outside. I remember having
Malcolm McLaren.
Malcolm McLaren, that tape.
Yeah.
And just playing it on repeat over and over and over and over again.
And, there weren't names for things. There weren't sub-genres within.
No.
Within hip hop, that later became there's elements within hip hop with the b-boying, the graffiti art, the MCing, and the DJing. It was all kind of like, oh shit, what is this? This is all really amazing. And
well, it was sort of fusion for a while, wasn't it? Because it was informed by the advances in technology, and a lot of it came out of the jazz world as well. The jazz community had a huge influence on hip hop and rap and that whole thing as well, like Herbie Hancock and what he did, bringing the record scratching to the mainstream and so on.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I guess as a kid sort of growing up as with hip hop, like, but it hadn't been defined as to what it was or
right.
And so we were growing up with it, and it was growing up with us.
Yeah.
Well, it felt like that was the case. And I got into a few things, I was wandering around the streets up to no good, painting on public property and
painting.
It's a nice way of creating art on public property. But I remember every street in our neighborhood had a crew. And we would just carry around, cardboard squares to break on.
Yeah. Like a music crew.
No, sort it was all, they were all
a posse.
Breakers,
Right.
So we'd just go around to the next street and sort of chuck the mat down and ghetto blaster and battle.
Interesting. So it's like the original throwdown.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
But I mean, we all knew each other from school anyway, right. So it wasn't like, oh, we're going into a hostile territory.
It wasn't an aggressive
thing. No, not at all.
It was just a geographical community sort of thing.
I mean, we were playing out what we saw on Beat Street, and what we saw on that Tuesday documentary. So that was my introduction to hip hop culture, and my introduction to DJing was who I think was the first within South Auckland anyway, and guys like Manuel Bundy and Ned Roy, who are dubbed like pioneers and that art form in this country, sort of they acknowledge DJ Vikey as the guy that was the first,
right,
and hadn't really been acknowledged as that guy. And to all, you know, there's been a bunch of documentaries about Aotearoa hip hop and the origins and so forth, and Vikey's never been mentioned. Mm. But for mine, he was the first DJ I knew of, and he would drive around in this purple van with he had the original boom sounds as well. So he had, you know, this was early 80s, so there was no such thing as car stereos or anything like that, you know, and or very
primitive ones, yeah, at least, yeah.
But he would have, like, you could hear Vikey coming,
right?
Yeah, and he would DJ a lot of the socials in the area, and you know, he influenced. Well, he would do a lot of the Mormon socials, and you know, Ned Roy was one of the, he must have been influenced by Vikey at some stage.
Mm-hmm.
And he took it to another level, and you know, I guess the rest is history in terms of how DJ culture in this country evolved, which, yeah.
You put me on to a really great documentary, just not directly, but it was in a Facebook post you put up, I think last week or the week before, and there was a documentary linked. You'd found an old one. It might have been Style Wars. Was it the?
Yeah.
But the documentary that was linked to that was one called Copyright Criminals, which I watched, and they got into the whole thing about stealing samples or ripping samples for hip hop beats, and you know, Clive Stubblefield was interviewed on there as well, and you know, so. That, when did that kind of thing start happening, where people were actually starting to make their own music from sampling other people? And when did that start happening here?
Well, this is my earliest.
Yeah, we're putting you on the spot. This is not really why we wanted to talk to you, because you know, we're not necessarily saying that you're a hip hop guru or anything like that. We actually wanted to talk about more like your music, but sure, all of the stuff is really interesting, and you grew up right in the thick of it, so you must have, you know, well, you've definitely got more experience than we have with it.
Well, it's I guess my earliest recollections of locally produced hip hop would be Upper Hutt Posse,
right?
I mean, Poor Year to an extent,
yeah, true.
And it was again so primitive in terms of what is hip hop, you know,
yeah.
And I really don't even know if what Upper Hutt Posse used to produce their music,
yeah.
What level of sampler they had? I know they sampled. It escapes me at the moment. But on their track, Do It Like This, and that was the first time a sample had been used by New Zealand,
right?
Crew collective. Outfit, yeah. And released it. To my knowledge, that there may be an earlier, but that's you know, in an almost primitive form, my earliest recollection of, and I didn't know the sample at the time. I didn't know it was sampled. I was like, oh, that's I like that.
And are we one of the only Western countries to have developed our own kind of unique hip hop sound? You know, because for me, we're not experts, but in the early 2000s, we got bands like, well, you even got Supergroove coming through and doing some, you know, rapping in their music, but also Nijin Mystic, Shafu, DLT, and Chains. And those guys started coming through with some really unique sounds that shaped a sound that was uniquely New Zealand or Pacifica.
Yeah, well, I do think that our New Zealand's leaning towards that style of music goes back to, I think, the Māori and Pacific cultures within this country, and their, I guess, their perceived connection to minority cultures that were representing themselves in this way in poor neighborhoods. Right. Yep. So I think they felt this affiliation to it.
Yeah.
So I think that put us, you know, and we were also a Western country, but had this ethnic minority,
mm.
Largely in poor socioeconomic communities. Mm. So I think there was that automatic association with that music. And I think that coupled with, I'll reference my dad's generation, you know, mm. a lot of their music was Motown inspired.
Right. Okay.
So yeah. There was, you know, I guess we were disenfranchised as a people and oh, you know, who could we connect to on an international level? Who was excelling at an international level that we felt like some connection to? And I guess that was the African American communities and the Latin American communities that were doing things that we could see ourselves mm. like, oh geez, that reminds us of us. And plus it was, you know, it's dynamic in terms mm. of like the breakdancing and stuff. It's easy to get excited by it, easy to be drawn to it. So I think these things lent themselves to why New Zealand had this affiliation to hip hop music. And I mean, I look at Australia, and who also had an ethnic minority, mm. But for whatever reason, their hip hop scene is a lot less developed.
I don't know. I can't speak for that culture, but it feels like from our vantage point here is that ethnic minority group doesn't have as strong a voice as say the Maori and Pacific voice does in this country.
They're far less integrated over there, aren't they?
Yeah, yes. It seems to be that they're more kept at arm's length in a way.
Yeah,
in many ways they're not even really prominent in the cities. They're, you know, sort of kept in out of the cities in a way, aren't they? Generally speaking,
I think so.
And I think that played an effect, and you know, because geographically we're really close. So what are the differences?
Yeah.
as to why one country took a leaning to a style of music, whether it was soul, R&B, the Motown thing, or which later became hip hop, and a country very close to us.
Mm.
Didn't, you know, and international artists that come down here do acknowledge the strength of our culture within
mm-hmm.
that genre.
Yeah.
And I'm talking about house music and
right.
You know,
I wonder if it's simply because the Aboriginal people just haven't, because they haven't been as integrated or as accepted into, you know, modern society in Australia, that they have stayed closer to their kind of original form.
Yeah, you know, I guess so.
Like in Africa, there are areas in Africa where the people there are very similar to the way they were hundreds of years ago. Then there's other areas in Africa where they also look a lot like American,
mm.
you know, the hip-hop scene and stuff is very similar, where they're more progressed in the cities and so on.
You know? Yeah, perhaps, man. I mean,
yeah.
It can only sort of speak from quite a distant observation of how Australia is and how they're, you know, their indigenous.
And everyone will have a different view too. You can only speculate. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, it gave rise, that whole phenomenon of that hip hop music and that style of, you know, early electronic music. I think Kraftwerk was. And their song Tour de France, I remember I got a cassette tape, and they featured on it the Tour de France, and you know, I had no idea who Kraftwerk were, and I just presumed that every group or artist producing this style of music was black, was African American.
Mm.
And later found out
Kraftwerk German,
they're German,
they? Yeah.
You know,
that doesn't mean they're not black though, but they're German. Are they? They're just white German boys.
Yeah, yeah.
Aryan race, kind of. And, no, you can't make Nazi jokes.
But you know, and then later found out, you know, they're German.
Yeah.
And then digging deeper into the origins of.
Did you just repeat that because you thought we'd edit out the bit about the Nazis? We won't.
You're leaving it there,
Bobby. We won't do that. It'll stay.
No, well,
it seemed like you were giving it a good cut because you're a professional, because you've done radio work, and we'll get to that too,
yeah,
at some point. But anyway, yeah, yes, they're Germans.
So where I was going was connecting the Kraftwerk back to to African-American culture, because, you know, I found, I was like, oh, they're Germans. I was like, oh, shit. You know, they were producing early hip-hop music. It was, you know,
right.
electronic fully, yeah. but I, you know, I perceived all in my ignorance
yeah.
that all electronic music in that field was done by African-Americans. And but later found out that they were influenced by guys out of Detroit who were the, you know, earliest you know, techno producers. And so again, as we'll get into a bit later, you know, with my role in George FM and so forth, that the perceived dance culture and techno music and so forth, just I guess so that's a real brutal term for dance music.
Yeah, and there are so many different. When I worked in music retail, you know, this is around the time that they were doing those massive dance raves. Basically, were all the rave, and there were so many different. There's Handbag House and there's Screaming. I heard
what's Handbag House?
I don't know. I don't know. They all sounded the same to me. But anyway, we'll get to that because we both worked in music retail around the same time. We didn't know each other, but we do know some of the same people. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about your earlier influences. Still, you know, you talked about how your dad would play Motown records and had probably quite a large music collection. Was there a conscious point did you take to go, actually, I just love listening to this vinyl here and doing something with that, as opposed to picking up a guitar like your dad did and learning an instrument?
Well, I mean, we had guitars, so I learned how to play the guitar. You know, never enough to call myself a guitarist. You know, could jump on the drums and hold a beat, but never enough to call myself a drummer. Likewise with the bass.
I've witnessed all of these things.
Oh yeah,
and you're neither of
them. Yeah, no. So, I wanted to. I felt like I had something to express, something to get out of me.
Yeah, yeah.
It was just, I guess, that being seduced by that hip hop representation of music, turntables fascinated me.
Yeah.
I remember my dad. We had a turntable. And whenever, you know, I had a moment to get on there, I would just try and scratch on it and ruin his multiple needles and ruin a lot of records. But yeah, my dad, he was listening to everything from the Beatles to Aretha Franklin to James Brown to Jaco Pastorius. And as a bass player, that, you know, I remember he sat me down as, I think it was like 7 or 8, and he said, look, I'm gonna play you this, close your eyes and listen to what he's doing with the bass. I was like, I don't even know what a bass guitar is, you know.
Right.
It's like, they're all guitars. And he goes, just listen. So I would sit there, and at the time it felt like torture listening to Jaco Pastorius.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, what the hell is this, you know? It was, you know, you would know.
Yeah.
It's a difficult listen today, but I mean, I can now listen to it and really appreciate the technicality and
what I find doing. Yeah, I find some Miles Davis hard to listen to.
Yeah. So, you know, I was like, well, that's awful, and I had no idea how that would influence me later as a DJ. And as I fell into DJing, because I fell into it after years of collecting records, never being able to afford turntables, that how those introductions to jazz and soul music would shape my style of DJing.
Yeah, because you've got quite a conscious sort of approach to it, haven't you?
Yep.
So how did you fall into it to start, first of all? Right, DJing as an art form.
Right. So I years of collecting records. My brother collected records. And I'd been living in Australia and decided I wanted to do something within the music industry in New Zealand, and so I had a reasonably good job in Sydney and was, you know, setting myself up to bring my family over. I was like, shit, no, I really want to follow my father's footsteps and decide to come home and try and do something. So I was organizing events in the city, and long story short, got landed with a whole bunch of debt, and had some turntables fall out of the equation.
Was that a promotion that you were doing that went badly wrong that you got stuck with the bill for?
Oh, I was working with some dodgy guys.
Okay.
Yeah.
In Sydney.
No, back in Auckland.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and
don't name any name.
No. I was very naive.
Yeah.
As well. But you know, hugely passionate about doing something.
Yeah.
So anyway, lumped with this debt and some turntables, and I was like, oh shit. Fortunately, at the time, I'd been asked to come up onto George, and
right.
and to do, you know, to be interviewed about the shows I was organizing.
What kind of shows were they?
They were cabaret style.
Uh-huh.
In terms of they weren't genre specific.
Strippers. Right. What's cabaret style? cabaret
and not cabaret, but they were more. They definitely couldn't be defined by a genre.
Right.
Oh, I mean, okay. For example, we had. I organized events with, on one card there was a gospel band, poets, a couple
weather. Oh, I see what you mean.
A couple weather dance group.
Right. These like ticketed events.
Yeah.
That sort of thing.
Drum and bass
right,
collectives.
Yep.
So, you know, and this is very early days of underground dance music in this yep. country.
So you're sort of being a promoter at
yeah,
the time.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. And out of a few things going wrong, I had an opportunity to go and meet some people on George, and and at the same time I was working in music retail, mm-hmm. as Bobby mentioned. So I was selling records and, you know, hustling vinyl to whoever would, you know, listen to my opinion
yeah.
on what I thought was good.
I like that about the old record stores. We don't really have that so much now. I mean, we don't have record stores.
No, it was a big part of the job. It was actually a really enjoyable part of the job too.
As a customer, I liked going in and saying, right, I've got this album and I want something like that, but with a bit of that. And they'd say, you should check out this, you know?
Yeah. Now you've got an algorithm telling you what,
yeah.
what you should
playlists
be
playlists and shit.
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess it has its advantages, but the fact that human touch.
Yeah.
You can't beat it.
No.
Yeah, well, that knowledge that you bring to the job as well, or to the... And you might suddenly be inspired by something that's a little bit left of centre and not exactly what they think they want, what they've asked for. They'll bring something up and they'll go, hey, I really love the sound of this, or you know, what they're hearing in the store.
Mm.
And you'll go, yeah, that's really cool, but have you maybe have a look at this and try this? And then yeah. it's really satisfying for them to have taken your opinion on board. So that's kind of, I guess, what you were saying, eh? Like,
yeah.
People are listening to what you...
Totally. And yeah. I mean, that became an extension of, you know, looking back... Essentially, it's what a DJ does.
Yeah, right.
So, I mean, I have some opinions on a DJ's role and within the music industry is too. So, I'd like to share those with you guys.
Yeah, go for it. Yeah.
So, I mean, a lot of DJs look at themselves as entertainers,
mm-hmm.
And I look at DJing. As you know, there's a part of what we're doing is entertaining, obviously.
Mm.
But I leant, this is just me, I leant more on we're actually educators. And what I mean by that is, like, I'm not teaching anyone how to do what I'm doing,
mm-hmm.
but what I'm doing, what I felt like I had my role was to introduce new music to an audience. And so I looked at my radio shows and my sets as an opportunity to play new music to new ears. And one, purely because I wanted to hear new stuff, and I was on this journey that I was like, oh well, I played this record twice. It's old now, I need to play something new.
Mm.
And I felt like, well, I couldn't play that again because I've heard it so many times, so these people don't want to hear it either.
Right.
Which was totally not the case because you're playing to new people every time. So I had to adjust my radar. But that was my philosophy around DJing, was not to play the big tune. Was never to play the big tune. Actually was trying to avoid the big tune.
Right.
Was to uncover a new piece of music that had those same qualities as the big tune that somebody had. It's like, oh, I love this tune.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you heard it before. So what's
Yeah.
It's like a drug, you know? It's
yeah.
like,
oh, bro, play something we all know.
Ah, hey, Bobby Kennedy. Yeah. No, it's, you know, that was my approach to it, you know? And like I said, it's like a drug, you know? You go down a path with the song, and it satisfies you for so long, and then you become immune to it.
Right.
You know, I'm not talking saying this to you guys because I know you guys do drugs.
Or anything. Well, I see you did wipe your nose when you said that. It's like a drug.
Yeah, but that's what it was like. You know, I was like, I needed to find something new. I needed to find something new to get that same feeling.
Yeah,
to discover something new,
mm-hmm.
and I felt like, well, that was my role as a DJ to discover new stuff, to play it to people, because I felt that 99% of the people were listening to 1% of the music produced.
Right.
So
right. I great, cool. Yeah.
And I felt like I had a duty to the other 99% of the music that was being made to expose that to more people.
Yeah.
And
which is more the case now, isn't it?
Totally.
Yeah.
It's gotten even worse. And that's what you became known for with your radio show on Georgia FM. What was this? Brown Chocolate?
Chocolate Sunday.
Chocolate Sunday.
Well, it should be brown, I guess, unless it's Milky Bar. But yeah, that was my approach to it. Was every, and I mean, I was on that one show. I was with George for 14 years, but that particular show, I did for 12 years, and I wanted each week. I tried to have at least, you know, looked at 80% of the show was new.
Right.
So that was, I mean, how many weeks in a year?
Mm.
Over 12 years, you know, right. So, and trying to come up with 30 songs.
That's a shitload of new music you're putting out there.
Mm.
And would they be lesser known tracks from name artists, or would they, doesn't matter, they could be a non...
Yeah, totally. B-sides from... On certain 12 inches that were released, but again, once I started my journey down a rabbit hole with a certain sound, then it just got, you know, deeper and deeper, and I think that's really how I forged a career out of it. You know, managed to do a bunch of travel and raise a family and pay for a mortgage on it, and it certainly wasn't, I wasn't the greatest technically.
Did the radio station itself give you any guidance, or, you know, require you to play anything or not play anything?
No,
they just left it to you.
No, that was a beautiful thing about George then.
Mm.
Then,
right?
Emphasize then.
Yeah, yeah.
that it was. They had people in there that were passionate about music.
Well, that's what the radio DJ actually originally was on all radio stations.
Exactly.
Wasn't it? Someone who had, they brought their character to the song choices.
Well, exactly.
And now it's never like that anymore.
No.
And George isn't like that anymore either, is it?
No, it's horrible.
George, yeah. I'm guessing George was probably one of the last ones to do that though, right?
But see, George built their reputation on being not like everybody else.
Right.
You know?
No, exactly. I mean, and George, and I have a philosophy on the radio phenomenon that came out of Auckland too. And if you don't mind,
we'll talk about that in a sec. But I just wanted to go back to when you were talking about you built a career on your choices and your eclectic kind of. And we've talked about it before, you and I, where you've said people have offered you good money to do the traditional DJ route, and you go, well, that's not for me. You've got the integrity to go, actually, that's not my style. I can do that stuff, and sometimes you will do it for fun, but there are times where you're like, no, this is what I do. I introduce new music, or otherwise, if you're not enjoying it, you're not gonna.
Yeah, I mean, I remember a colleague at George saying, you know, why aren't you playing the Owl House parties? Everybody's good as those guys. I'm like, and I'm not saying that every guy that played at those Owl House parties were cheesy.
Yeah.
But I would feel dirty about doing something that wasn't. I didn't feel true to what I was trying to represent myself as an artist, and what I felt was a duty to that 99% of the music.
Right.
It's a grey area, though. Like, I picked up on, you know, you said the word integrity when you asked that question. But it's just a personal decision, though, isn't it? But it's like with musicians. Some musicians think it's anti their integrity to play a covers gig.
Right.
But for other musicians, it's just their job. And, you know, yeah. like, it's like a decision you make inwards. It's not supposed to be an outward thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, if someone else wants to play those parties, like, knock yourself out. Enjoy it.
Enjoy absolutely. It. Yeah. And you know, there are a ton of DJs doing that.
Yeah.
And, you know... If that's, like I was saying, that, you know, there were some DJs that saw themselves as entertainers,
yeah,
and some that see themselves more as educators, and I leant on that side of things, so it was more, I maybe to a flaw, had a passion about taking music to that level, and I may have lost out in some elements, but I certainly, you know, managed to forge a career, staying true to what I felt I should be doing as
which
a
is cool. That's yeah. fine. Yeah. I just know within the music community, there's a lot of like outward shit. You know, I do this, but I don't want to do that. Those people who do that are selling out and all that kind of crap.
Totally. Within DJ communities, I mean, there are a lot of wankers. You know, I mean, there are a lot of wankers.
Well, there's wankers everywhere.
Everywhere.
The world is full of wankers.
Yeah. But, you know, I could totally have been perceived as being, oh, you're a snobby music snob, you know. But I never went into it for a career.
Right.
The career kind of happened out of what I felt passionate about.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So I was really, really fortunate like that. And you know, a lot of DJs, far superior technically, would ask me, and I, you know, it's kind of insulting. It was like, how are you getting all these gigs? You know, how are you getting paid?
We've talked about this all the time too on the show. And it's, just being a good guy and being good at what you do, you know, and having something that's different from everybody else.
Yeah. The good guy thing, can't understate that.
Yeah.
You know, if you're a dickhead in whatever industry, you're burning bridges left, right, and center.
That's right.
And actually, I'm not sure if you're comfortable bringing this up, but I think we'll get to it about there is a non-good guy story around the Georgie Pepper thing, which we can talk about if you're willing to.
Sure, yeah, happy to.
But you wanted to talk a little bit about the underground radio scene, because you started a radio station, didn't you, like a community...
Yeah,
well, you wouldn't call it a community station, but what do you call it?
Low powered FM station. I mean, I was doing mornings at George, and we had a jazz guitarist, well, two jazz guitarists come in with a couple of MCs, and they were being interviewed on George, and they said, "Oh, look, can you play some instrumentals for us, and we'll just freestyle jam on air." So yeah, sure. So we did that, and then the guy that had organized it, who came through, he says, "Look, can I take you to breakfast?" And I was like, "Hey, you know, of course."
If you want no such thing as a free breakfast.
yeah. So and he goes, "Look, I really enjoyed that. I think there's opportunity for me to start my own radio station." And he goes, "You know, would you be willing to come on board if we did that?" I was like, "Yeah, sure, whatever, pal." Just where's my free breakfast?
Feed me.
Yeah. And not much has changed, but So KFM was born from that, and I had an opportunity to manage that a community radio station, and that was it was born on, I guess, the jazzy elements of what we were doing at George.
Yeah.
KFM,
is that in relation to K Road?
Yep.
Right. Is that where it's based?
Yeah, that's where it's based.
Yeah.
And I think it's now morphed into, it's renamed, it's rebranded itself as The Plug, and still with LPFM.
Right.
But the after, you know, years and George and coming through KFM and being involved with Bass FM and Fleet FM, and, you know, I really started to develop a perspective of how unique Auckland's radio community was, and I was like, "How did this happen? How did this happen?" Obviously, our laws around rights to frequencies and being able to freely broadcast to a limited radius, there was no restrictions on it. It's
right.
Like if it was a spare free frequency, and you had an aerial, you could go for it.
Is that restricted by radius though? You can only transmit so far.
Yep. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
You know, what's the distance?
I think it was like a 10, 15 k radius.
Okay. That's actually quite far.
Yeah.
Hence the low powered frequency.
Yeah. But you couldn't go beyond that.
Right. That means you could reach a lot of Auckland though.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
So I was like,
as far as Newmarket, would it be further than that?
I reckon it'd be central. Further than that.
Yeah, it depend on the position of the aerial.
Yeah, right.
Oh, you've got to get up high enough,
yeah,
eh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but I was like, how did this thing happen? Purely observing the environment I was working in, and I was loving it. But noticed Fleet FM, Bass FM, Up FM, George FM, KFM. I was thinking, shit, what gave birth to this?
Mm.
And there were beautiful genres, you know, well, such diverse genres that were coming out. You know, there was reggae, there was, the techno elements, there was the dub, the hip hop, the alternative indie rock and so forth that Fleet were coming with. And it had a beautiful following in a community that flourished for a period of time. And looking back, while I was in it, I was observing it and noticed that all of these stations had what I call the DNA of B.
Okay.
Which was that I look to BFM as giving birth to all these children.
Right. Okay.
And obviously the grandfather of them all would have been Radio Hauraki.
Right. The Pirates.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a pirate radio.
Yeah.
And there was the conditions for a perfect storm to give birth to all of these children.
Mm.
And when I realized, I was like, far out, this is a beautiful, beautiful thing that's happened in our city. And it kind of just happened really organically. And it hadn't been noted or observed because everyone was in their own pockets doing their own thing. You know, I'm a DJ on Fleet FM, or I'm a DJ on B, or I'm on Bass FM. But I stood back for a second. I mean, I'm probably not the only one. And go, wow, this is a really beautiful phenomenon that's happened.
What's really interesting to me is that humans all over the world have always, in their own little corners of the world, have repeated a lot of the same stuff. You know, like,
yeah.
The way that harmony and rhythm has been developed and progressed before cultures were already communicating with each other.
Yeah.
And also like concepts of God and all that kind of stuff.
Mm.
But that pirate thing, the Hauraki story, is actually not unique.
No.
That same story has played out many times around the world.
Yeah.
Yeah, back in those days.
Yeah.
And I mean, and then the subcultures that came, like you say, that came from that.
Totally.
It's repeated itself all over the place.
Totally.
Isn't it interesting?
Yeah, London is a prime example.
Right.
And all the Pirate FM. All of that,
yeah,
that
the idea of using the boat off the coast,
yeah,
it happened a number of times.
Totally,
yeah,
and you know, for it to happen in a place like Auckland, because there wasn't one person leading it.
No,
there would have been that initial let's do this pirate radio thing, but who would have thought from Radio Hauraki, the guys broadcasting out in the harbour. That they would give birth to like to BFM, who would spawn these beautiful children, and that there was all these choices within Auckland for people to connect with, and it was so diverse.
Yeah,
whatever your feel of music, you know, you could find it on independent community radio, and you know, being a part of that and its prime was, you know, something I'm really quite proud of.
Right. And it seems to me that it's about, you know, we go through these phases where circumstances or politics or whatever tries to suppress the human spirit, but we seem to rise out of it somehow. You know, like back in the 60s, culture was, when one half of the culture was resisting the other half of the culture, and all of these things played out, you know, and then... Funnily enough, that particular station rises up and becomes one of the most commercial stations we have.
Yeah.
Most of us get completely bored with it, and then we start looking for what can we do now?
Exactly, which I guess is a nice segue into what happened with George.
Yeah, and where it's okay,
right. Yeah, let's talk about that. Curious, actually.
So the wheels fell off George. I would say, what was it, a couple of years ago now, 2 years ago, where they just started cutting people left, right, and center. DJs who'd been there for yonks and yonks and yonks. What happened there?
Well, I mean, it was the net. Like we were saying, it's the natural evolution of things.
Yeah.
You know, George, as I knew it, was responsible for underground dance culture, mm-hmm. And music in Auckland and New Zealand, and it's been accredited internationally for being there.
Wow.
Now, as things evolve and grow and change, and media works happens, it led to, I guess, a commercial formulaic mode of operation,
mm-hmm.
Where there were amazing tastemakers on George FM and amazing DJs who were cut for the vision of homogenizing that sound,
right?
You know, it didn't quite fit, I guess, what MediaWorks were used to. I mean, MediaWorks came on board and they all got us all together in the room and says, "Look, the whole point of the whole we're not going to don't there's no have no fear about MediaWorks coming on board. We're not going to change anything because we've acquired George. This was the message. We've acquired George because of its point of difference. We have the edge. We have the blah blah blahs."
Did they actually use the word acquired?
Well, no, they didn't.
But essentially what happened, though, right?
Yeah, yeah. That's essentially what happened. Is that, you know, in order for George to survive, they had to go there, I suppose.
Right.
But they were reassuring that, you know, that we wouldn't be introducing changes because of, you know, the culture that George was. They wanted to amplify that, I guess, is what they were.
Oh, okay.
You know, we
probably capitalize is a better word.
That's probably more accurate.
Yeah.
So they're like, you know, underground dance music is what George is all about. Blah blah blah. And then one by one, changes started to happen.
Yeah.
You know, amazing DJs and musicians that were working there. We're cut, you know,
right.
And I guess the more to the left you were with your sound, the more you were likely to get your head chopped off.
Yeah,
They
can't help it, can they?
No,
they're not the creators.
No,
yeah,
no,
they don't get it. They just it's just in their nature to try and even everything out.
Yeah,
and make everything fit the template.
Yeah,
why you know the culture we've got of committees taking over. Committees shouldn't be making creative decisions.
No.
They shouldn't be telling us who the artists are, or the station, or the DJs are, or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. They should just get fucked, basically.
Yeah. They should, yeah. Amen. But I mean, before we get back into that, because I really wanted to touch on this some more, but
yeah.
I would like to say that, you know, a lot of the best DJs I worked with I also have a strong sense of musicality and also have a background in music as musicians.
Right.
Which shouldn't surprise anyone,
right?
Mm. And a lot of these guys also were some of the guys, most of the guys that got cut from George,
yeah,
and replaced them with a lot of, you know, people that were prepared to be told what to play, which again was the opposite end of the spectrum as to what George was,
right?
You know, it was like, well, George wanted you because you were left,
yeah,
but if you lean to the left, it's like,
yep,
you're out.
It's like your dad discovering Facebook and then suddenly, you know, taking over your timeline and you go, oh, fuck, yeah. It's not cool anymore. I don't want to be involved.
And then the Max Key thing happened.
Yeah, so, okay, you went there. So what happened there?
Yeah, well, I mean,
I mean, I'm completely in the dark about all of this.
Do you know who Max Key is?
I just know he's the guy who wears the bandanas.
But it's John Key's son.
Yeah. I know, but the bandanas is way more interesting than the fact that he's John Key's son.
yeah, so
you, Just walk us through when you opened your email or when you walked. I don't know how it was announced to you that that's what was happening, but you were still at George at the time.
Yeah.
And someone presumably lets you know that, hey, John Key's son, what's his name? Max, is coming on board. What were your feelings when you first heard that?
So Max came on board as a DJ.
Yeah, totally.
Is that what happened?
Yeah, yeah. So we got this, you know, they made the announcement, and then there were DJs that were like, what the?
Let's back up the truck a little bit, because it just occurred to me, MediaWorks, who owns TV3?
Yeah.
Is that right? They're the same company that shot the Golden Goose with John Campbell show because John Key had an issue with John Campbell,
yeah,
right, with the way that he interviewed, and mm-hmm. He was a bit sort of left of centre, I guess, was the liberal, was the thing that John Key is not known for. But he was. That seems to be the reason that they shut down the John Campbell show. I forget what it was called. Was it John Campbell show?
Campbell Live,
right? Yeah. So it just occurs to me that they're the same company. Now, call me a conspiracy theorist.
Okay.
you'd be quicker than that. suddenly, John Key's son is being foisted upon you. Was there a job application? Was there a job opening?
No. But, I mean, to get an opportunity on George, because every DJ in the city wants to be on George.
Of course, everyone wants to be on George.
You had to, you know, pay
climb
your dues.
Up, climb up the ranks.
Yeah, pay your dues, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wait, so had Max actually been a DJ before?
No, he announced he was a DJ.
Oh, right, you just said he was.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I'm a DJ too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, anyway, we're all DJs.
Yeah. I've got a record player.
Yeah. And, I mean, leading up to...
the difference between a disc jockey and a dick jockey.
So I guess leading up to it, there were, you know... We were never told what we could or couldn't say.
Yeah.
From my earliest days at George, never told what we could say on air, what we couldn't say on air. MediaWorks started saying, "Oh, look, you can't talk about this, you can't talk about that." I was like, "What the fuck's that all about?" You know. So.
And these are political things, or what? Just anything, or
political.
Whatever they felt like on that day.
It was mostly political,
right?
Was it leaning towards one end of the spectrum more so than the other?
No.
Or was it just the environment we were in because of the government we have?
Yeah, yeah. And I guess with MediaWorks' position as a you know, major player, they didn't want any of their DJs voicing opinions, political opinions mostly.
Right.
But that was like a what the fuck moment for me because I was right. I'll say what I want to say.
Yeah.
And I did, you know, and... I continued to, to my ultimate demise. But I was like, no, I'll. The moment anyone, I always said it, you know, the moment anyone tells me what to play on radio or even at a gig, you know, that's it. I'm out.
Mm.
So, you know, I have, as you know, I'm highly opinionated. Politically and socially, so I've voiced my opinion openly on George, and then we started receiving emails. You can't say this, you can't do that, and I was like, oh fuck, it started.
This is before Max. It was
before Max,
Key, right?
And then Max came on board, and I should say leading into, well, Max made an announcement, and being who his father is, you know, he got some press around it. I'm a DJ now, and I won't name the program director and also DJ and electronic music producer.
I think you just did without doing it.
came out and made a statement publicly that, and he's a great DJ too and a great producer, but he came out publicly and said any club that would hire Max Key should be burnt.
Burnt down to the ground.
Yeah. Now,
this is when he announced himself as a DJ.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
So then it was announced that Max was fortunately I'm not tarnished by that Max Key brush. I had departed ways with George at that point, but I was still on the mailing list. So I was getting, you know, you can't say this, you can't say that.
Right.
These generic emails.
I thought they were just although they were like group emails to all the DJs to say, Can't say this, can't say that.
Did you get personal emails, though, referencing particular moments?
No, no.
That's gutless, man. Yeah. They'd make it diplomatic.
Yeah. And so then they announced, well, George, you know, Max is coming to George. And so the same guy, program director, DJ, producer.
Who had wanted to burn down any club that took him on as a DJ.
Yeah, yep. Totally. Flipped the B-side on it and said, you know, Max
started playing a different tune.
Max is a talent that we're really lucky to have on George. I was like, oh, bro, I lost all respect for you instantly.
Yeah, right.
You know,
why do you think he did that?
Cash money.
What, you think it was cash money? Or was there some other incentive?
No, he was getting paid by MediaWorks.
Right, okay.
Right. And then so
okay, so he had received one of those. He had received a personal email saying, "You think maybe I'm putting words in your mouth? Let me say it. I think he probably received an email and went and was told that you have to big up this kid.
I would imagine so.
Right.
That's
what it seems like.
Totally seems like
speculation. But
he had a choice, you know, as we all do, and he chose to make a public statement about, you know, no, Max is a talent and we're lucky to have him on George, and complete backflip on what he had said previously about the guy, which is entirely, well, it was more accurate, his initial statement of George, Max, that, you know, he's talentless and so forth.
Right.
So I don't know how you go from talentless to being a major talent that we're lucky to have and is an amazing producer.
Is there a chance that he'd heard his music at that point and gone, oh, well?
There's a chance that he produced the music for Max.
Right, okay.
I can't say that it was, but I, you know, from reliable sources inform me that the music Max Key was releasing,
right,
was purchased from another electronic music producer. So,
okay. Yeah,
because I don't really know anything about Max Key, I feel the need to ask, like, is there anything there from his point of view that you know, what would his defense be? I mean, are we just writing him off because he's John Key's son?
Oh,
is he getting a fair trial here?
No, that's writing him off instantly. No.
I mean, what if he is good? Is he good? Maybe he's a really nice guy.
I'm sure he's a lovely kid.
Yeah. He gives a lot of money to the Bandana Foundation.
Well, he certainly does. keeps him in business. No, I mean, I'm sure he's good at something. he's certainly getting. He's really good at applying a bandana symmetrically.
Right. He wasn't good at flipping burgers, apparently, though.
No. But that was his claim to being down with the people.
Yeah.
Working
at McDonald's.
I shouldn't beat up on the kid so much, you know.
I mean, I guess in some ways you'd think he would be an easy target, and this is maybe he, but he doesn't need that kind of mollycoddling, does he? Like, you know, you've got to, because wasn't there some direction that give this guy a chance, let him prove himself as a DJ before you go and out and slam him?
Totally. We were told as DJs not to say anything bad about Max.
No.
I mean, that was like,
but
I
it's
mean,
more the like, system. The system's at fault.
Sure,
you know, they're getting him in because he's a name and there's interest around him.
But he wasn't a name though. There's
clearly interest around him because we're talking about him, and they were talking about him then.
Yes, because controversy has sprung up around
that.
But at the time, there was no he didn't have a name. He announced himself as a DJ. Just like you literally did before. You go, well, I'm a DJ now. Well, that's probably exactly, you know.
But there must have been something about it, just simply the fact that he's his son. Because if I said I was a DJ, they probably wouldn't have even thought about it. They just, you know. But because he was the Prime Minister's son, you know, let's get him in because there's going to be a story there. And that's going to help the PR.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Yeah, I'm sure that would have been factored in some of it. It's like, well, you know, we will get some really good PR out of this.
Right.
Having Max Key on board.
So it's actually like, it's not really Max Key that's at fault. He's like a pawn in the whole thing.
Yeah. No. Nah.
He might still be a douche.
No. Yeah.
I'm just saying we don't know.
No, we don't. I mean, whether he actively pushed to be included on George and used his position to climb that pecking order and you know, bypass a lot of other DJs who had worked
hard. Because it gives him cred right now. It gives him cred. He's
totally
a DJ on George.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's a good thing. I'm just saying that that's perfectly normal.
And we, I don't know whether he used his position to get himself up there, whether Daddy pulled strings, whether any of that. But I mean, you take whatever opportunity, like you said, you take whatever opportunity presents itself.
We all do.
But you know, he can't then sort of sit back and say, well, you know, give me a break, but you know, respect me for being a great DJ. Well, you never proved yourself in the first place.
I totally agree.
So you can't have one without the other. You know, if you've used your position to advance, then you can't sit back and say, well, I paid my dues.
Yeah.
And you know, he's still battling that now. Funnily enough, you know, he's just getting beaten from pillar to post, and you got he's no longer with George.
Right.
I don't know whether it's got anything to do with his father resigning. Mm.
Pizzagate.
I don't know whether it's got anything to do with it, but you know, now he's getting beaten from pillar to post. Now, if I was the said program director, the producer, DJ, firstly bagged him, secondly endorsed him.
Yeah.
Now I was sitting there going, I endorse this schmuck that everyone is just beating on and saying how talentless he is. How does he feel right now?
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, you know.
And sounds like the sort of person that doesn't really care.
No, probably not. And as long as he's getting paid, he's probably, you know, and fair enough too. You know, we all got bills to pay. But, you know, what really got me about this particular person was that he, when this was being bandied about on social media, he took offense to another colleague of mine's opinion on social media.
Mm.
and says, you know, you can't be calling me a sellout and so forth. Well, if the shoe fits, wear it, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's basically it. And you know, I'm sure he might regret it, but you know, that's, for my mind, that's what I'll remember him for now. Not the music he's made, and that's a shame, because he's a talented guy.
Mm.
So you recently did the Splore gig. What's a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah.
But you've done quite a few big gigs around the place. Mm. How did you get into doing those things? Because was it from the George FM thing, or was it you? Because you do a number of residencies as well.
Sure. Yeah. Like, I mean, I was fortunate enough to have forged a career, getting paid to do something I'm hugely passionate about, and you know, a number of residencies around Auckland City and a number of beautiful establishments and travel and you know, play some amazing gigs, and I guess the highlight for me to date, and it's, you know, as I'm nearing the end of this journey as a DJ, was playing support for Roy Ayres.
Are you officially announcing your retirement?
No, I'm not officially announcing my retirement. Okay. Never say.
Damn,
never.
I thought it was going to be a scoop.
That would be the world's shallowest scoop.
But do you think at some time you'll hang up your needles?
I'll always buy records. I'll always DJ in my garage. But yeah, certainly the luster is dulled in terms of, you know, I want to play out, and I want to feel the, you know, have my ego stroked and all that comes with being on the other side. But yeah, I mean, playing for Roy Ayres, who, harking back to my hip hop days, and the influence he had on hip hop music, and house music and dance music, and I mean, as a jazz musician, he's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So to have found myself opening for this guy and in the green room with this guy and talking with him, and that by far is my highlight. And I mean, playing Splore is amazing. Playing Sound Splash and all these music festivals, and It's great. I mean, you guys both know the rush from performance, and the bigger the crowd, the bigger the rush, the more the anxiety. But again, it's like you come out the other side, and it's just the best feeling. But the desire to do that isn't as strong as it used to be.
Right.
But you know, having said that, loved playing Splore. The whole kaupapa of that festival is something that appeals to me, and there, that type of gig really allows me to be me.
Right.
You know, some parties or whatever, you feel like I should be sort of, you know, leaning on the party vibe or whatever, you know, Splore wants me to be me.
Right. Yep.
And
what's caused that desire to change? You're saying the desire is not there as much as it was.
I guess priorities change, I suppose, you know, as you get older and having a young family and not so young family. My focus has changed. But I'm getting my satisfaction creatively in other ways.
Right.
And I'm, you know, I guess that's sort of having me, swaying me towards,
yeah,
you know, but I'll always love doing that, expressing myself. But I mean, I'm probably doing a lot. Well, I want to do something we didn't touch on. Work on. I want to make more music.
Right.
Well, we can talk about that now.
Mm. Sure. Okay. Well, I was actually making music before I was a DJ.
Right.
And that was using samplers and
yeah,
and so forth. And I did a bunch of soundtrack production work. And it had, you know, the I remember producing a soundtrack for two or three series of an arts series that traveled across Asia and North America and a bunch of countries. Anyway, I was really naive about licensing of the music and so forth. Mm. So, I mean, I did it. I got paid to make it, and it was something I was already doing in my garage.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, the opportunity came to make some music and have it on, you know, put to a soundtrack. And I mean, there were times when I had, you know, barely 2 cents to rub together, you know.
Right.
And I remember going to the ATM and it's like, oh, you know, I'd like to get this. I need to check how much money I've got in my bank account. You know, maybe I got, you know, $20, maybe. So, you know, ATM, and then I'd just check my account. It's like $8,500 in there, and I'm like,
where the hell did that,
you know,
come
so
from?
I was looking around. I'm like, shit, did anyone see that I just saw? There's a mistake. There's no way I've done anything to earn.
Withdraw.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like, I'll take out as much as I can right now and not say anything to anybody.
Yeah.
And I got home and then checked an old bank statement a couple of weeks back, you know, that I'd never open them, but they just pile up.
Yeah.
And you don't tend to open them when you've got no money, eh?
No. No, so point. There's nothing to fucking look at. So anyway, I looked at it and I was like, oh, Apple royalties.
Right.
I was like, what? So yeah, that was, I remember that.
Jesus, vividly. $8,500 for Apple royalties.
Yeah. And
it's unheard of.
Well, see, because apparently what had happened was it went from, running weekly, series is 2, 3, and 4 that I made music for.
Yeah.
One particular summer, they went and replayed every episode, you know, every night of the week as a rerun.
Right.
At the same time, it was airing across Asia and North America and, like,
oh, nice,
you know, Canada and so forth. And, yeah. You know, I had no idea. Of course, you know, I didn't bother to chart its, you know, where it was being aired or whatnot. I was told it was going to go to air.
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah, 8.5K, so I was like, oh, Christmas. Yeah, but that's something I'd like to pursue more. It allows me to stay home.
Yeah.
And you know, be present for my family.
Right.
Because there was a long time where I was gigging full time. I would be there during the day, but the kids are at school.
True. Yeah.
And then in the evening, then I go to work. I will play a gig. And then come home really horrible hours in the morning and sleep through the weekend, right. Basically.
Yeah.
And
how many nights a week were you out?
With all the different pieces of the pie that I was working, maybe Wednesday through to Sunday.
Oh yeah.
That wasn't every week. Mm. You know, some weeks were better than others. But the weekends when the kids were actually home to spend time with, I was toast up in bed.
Right.
And needing to be present at night.
Yeah. Yeah.
That vampire life, I'm sure you're both familiar with.
Oh, yeah.
Tell me about it.
Which is great fun, but, you know, raising a family with it comes at a cost. Mm. And so, yeah, trying to make good on some of that time lost is driving me, and the decision not to sort of chase the yeah. gig.
How old are your kids now?
Oh, my eldest is 22.
Yep.
My daughter is 16, and my two youngest boys are 10 and 8.
Right.
So yeah, I'm trying to put more into the younger ones that you know, I can't take back what I missed with the older kids.
Sure. Yeah.
So I'm, you know, trying to redeem myself a little bit as a father, yet still maintain the sense of creativity. So just finding that balance a little better these days.
Right. Look, on that though, and this is a compliment, and I don't often pay you compliments, but the creative side of things, you know, you and I are a lot in the same meetings. We sit down and we nut out creative stuff. That's a big part of what we do for our day jobs, right? Mm. But you are one of the quickest, most creative people I know, in terms of you'll come left of center with something that I never even thought of, you know. Yeah, and and I think that's an incredible talent to have. You know, you'll suddenly go, how about we try doing something like that? And I can't give an example now because I don't really want to talk about a lot of the stuff we're doing. Sure. But it's an amazing kind of thing that I envy in you, in that you've got that real keen sense of a balance of creativity but also practicality, because a lot of creative people are not that practical in terms of, oh fuck it, I'll just do a rock opera. Actually, I've said that to myself in the last couple of years, I'm going to write a rock opera, and then having no idea how to do it or not the time or the resources to do it, whereas you are a very practical person, and it comes through with what you're saying as well, in terms of I've made a conscious decision to sort of pull back on the live gigging, and I'm just going to make music in the garage at night time when the kids are in bed, kind of thing.
So, thanks, bro.
Yeah.
And similar admiration to you, because I mean, you know, like you said, creatives that have also a strategic mind and an analytical mind and a real practical sense of reality. Not always in balance. So, you know, sometimes I feel that I am too far in the creative and I need to rein myself in. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, as creatives, we're blessed with the ability to think that way naturally.
Yeah.
Without having to, like, I want to be a creative. No, it's like, well, you either are or you aren't.
Right.
And to be blessed with those instincts, yeah, I'm super grateful for.
I feel like each person has a leaning one way or the other, and they do themselves the best favor if they try and balance themselves out. You know, those that have analytical minds or are great as accountants or whatever, you know, would do themselves a favor to learn to think creatively too, innovatively. And vice versa.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely, man. I think as humans, I think in our spirit, we need to be creative.
Yeah.
I think by nature, we need to be creative.
Right. But at the same time, we need to also know how to apply it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we're just sort of
turning around in circles.
Or, or sometimes rein it in too.
Yeah.
Like I say, and that comes down to the practicality thing, being practical about what you can and can't do.
And I wonder if this comes full circle back to your first experiences with music, which you said at the start was helping your dad load in the PA, load in the speakers. There's something very, you know, mechanical, and it's a job, and it's heavy, and it's hard work. And your first introduction to the music industry was, this is a job.
Yeah, yeah. And it was, and what it also was very real.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't a perspective of stars in your eyes.
Right.
It's
practical.
It was my dad did it. It was
functional.
You know? Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Yeah.
And which made it completely real for me.
Mm.
And thinking creatively or being creative wasn't a freakish thing to have.
Although right.
There were times growing up there where I did feel, you know, I'll get a real job.
Yeah.
Being
a sports-centric country, the creative community isn't always...
No, it's not acknowledged.
Accepted.
It's not acknowledged. You know, get a real job. But I'm like, what's not real about raising a family of four?
Right.
Paying for a mortgage. I'm supporting my parents as well. You know, what's not real about that? I might not be working a 9-to-5, but... the money was real.
Yeah.
And I think we'd do well in society to encourage that way of thinking and that way of looking to create and earn for yourself.
Well, it probably doesn't help that we're, as a creative community, we're always trying to present ourselves as being like these kind of rock star, you know, living at large kind of things. We don't really also talk much about the reality of the job.
No. No, I mean, and I guess from the exterior it can be a look like an illusion.
Yeah,
it is totally an illusion.
And a lot of people out there just go okay, and they take what you give them.
Yeah,
you know.
But I think being a creative and being musically inclined, I guess, I can speak for mostly. It's a lifestyle choice at the end of the day. Sometimes you know you do have to face the reality that sometimes times are going to be tough. And you do have to go out there and hustle and find work and shape your career. And you're someone who's had a very sort of strong vision and you've been able to do that. And it feels a little bit like, and we hear stories. I mean, we talked to Sheree Matheson about it a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
And you and I have also talked to Sheree about that kind of gig economy that seems to be coming through, where people are choosing lifestyle over fortune. You know,
totally.
And it seems, you know, people are saying by 2040, 60% or whatever it is of the economy, of the workforce, will be that gig economy, where they're just doing short-term things, and it'll be upon them to, oh, shit, I'm running out of cash now, I've got to go and get another job for a little bit.
Mm.
But then they'll choose lifestyle again, you know.
Well, it makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, people are finding out over and over again that they get everything that they thought they wanted and they're still not happy, you know. And then the housing market crashed and the recession and all that stuff. Like, the things we're supposed to rely on don't always stay true.
Yeah.
No, you know? Exactly.
And then, you know, they're sitting in traffic an hour and a half each way each day going, what the fuck am I doing?
Yeah.
And then fucking Trump happens.
Yeah. And you're like, well, you know, let's all just go and live on that there? Farm up north. Yeah.
We can go there.
No, well, I mean,
but literally, Sheree said the same thing,
right?
And that whole thing about Trump came about, and it's like, okay, the game has changed.
Yeah,
it's a lot of people. I've heard other people say the same thing. The world is not what you thought it is. You know, buckle up, buttercup. Do whatever the fuck you want to do now. You don't have to rely on the norm. There is no norm anymore.
Well, it was always like that. It's just that most people didn't
tend to realize. No. We put self-imposed restrictions on what that was.
That's right.
And what success is.
That's right.
You know.
What's your version of success?
Well, you know, I felt, you know, not so much at the time, but I guess towards the end of my full-time DJs gigging and so forth. And when I'm being fronted with the question, get a real job, you know, I felt like, well, I'm doing something I love. I'm getting paid for it. I'm not wealthy, but I'm getting paid for it.
Yeah.
Stop and appreciate that and realize that that's, you know, not everyone gets to do that.
Right.
No, that's right.
It's actually very rare.
Yeah. And I felt at that point, no, you're a success.
Yeah.
You know, you've raised a family, you're years through paying a mortgage and almost mortgage free, and you know, you did it by doing something you loved.
Yeah.
And at the extreme end of it too, because it wasn't the superstar club DJ that was playing all the top 40 hits. You know, so I really have to take stock of what I had achieved there, and not to big up myself, but you know, it certainly wasn't the charted course.
Mm.
But it happened, and I'm very grateful for it. I mean,
As you should be.
Yeah. Totally. And I think we may have touched on it before. I certainly had this discussion, you know, and so, you know, when I was in the throes of that, I had to, I'm sure you guys would be well familiar with having to apply the same philosophy to your life, to your careers. And that is, you know, have to have a few fingers and a few pies as a creative,
mm-hmm.
that this society isn't built for us.
No.
So we have to be flexible within it to make ends meet. So I had my fingers in a few pies, you know. I mean, I was doing TV work, both in the production side and in presenting. Mm. I was doing extra work as an actor.
Right.
I was, you know,
producing. That's where I've seen you before.
Gay porn. Street, fuck. Bobby, I promise you wouldn't say that. No, you know, living off royalties, getting gigs and doing, you know, community radio station work, you know, so it certainly wasn't from one stream of money that I was able to quantify, this level of success,
right.
or to pay for everything that I'd achieved. And, so, you know, I always try and share that with young creatives. It's like, don't lock yourself into one way of thinking.
That's right.
Because you have to be, you have to be creative about how you make money as a creative.
Yeah,
I think that's a really great point.
Yeah, I think of that as the jazz musician mentality, where they go, I play jazz and I listen to jazz and I do not do anything else.
Yeah,
they take on this whole identity.
Yeah,
and then they sit there for a while and they go, I have no money.
I'm cool.
I'm a struggling artist. Yeah. And that's more than...
And the hungrier they get, the more open they get.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you see them at the next gig playing Mustang Sally in 500 miles.
Yeah. I feel like a lot of those people who are saying to you, get a real job, what they're really saying is, no, you don't deserve to be happy. You should be as miserable as I am in the job that I fucking hate doing from 9 to 5, 40, 60 hours a week. You don't have the right to be happier than me.
Yeah. It does feel like
that,
doesn't
it? Who do you think you are?
Yeah.
And you know, totally amongst the privileged few.
Yes. That's exactly who you are. Yes.
Yeah. And, you know, like I said...
But you worked at it. It's not like...
I always point out you have to hustle, man.
Yeah.
And if you can't hustle as a creative, the fuck out of the business.
Right.
Yeah. Totally.
When people say that to me, when they say, well, you know, you love what you do, I'm like, well, I don't always love what I do. I love some of what I do, but I'm on a journey. It's like an adventure, but... You know, there are days that fucking suck.
Yeah, it's a grind, man. And there's no escaping the grind. Whether you're doing it the linear way, the way society perceives you should be doing it, by working a 9 to 5, or whether you're doing it as a creative and in a number of different streams, there's a grind.
Right.
And there's no easy way, or
there's no shortcut.
There's no silver bullet to it, man. Unless you're born into money.
Right.
But I guess that comes with its own struggles. I wouldn't know.
No, neither would I.
But
yeah, if you're born into money, you could just declare that you're a DJ all of a sudden.
Touche.
Or, you know, oh, fuck, I'm a DJ. Oh, tomorrow I'm a barber. Yeah. And, you know, you do whatever you want. You don't have to worry about...
Just appreciate me for the artist that I am, because I'm super talented. And it's got nothing to do with my dad.
On that note, on dad notes... thanks so much for your time, man. And it's a genre of music that I don't know much about, so it's great to get that kind of vibe happening.
Awesome, thanks for having me, guys. Really, really enjoyed it.
What are you talking about?
Like,
you know
about
the song. What song? And I was talking to also people quite a lot younger as well. No, what do you mean?
Right. Yeah.
What's a mutton bird?
Well, For those of you who have just joined us, we were talking about Dominion Road because our little studio here is just off Dominion Road. And
yes.
We pick up a bit of traffic noise. Yeah. And so we're literally halfway down Dominion Road.
We are. Actually, yes. Yeah, I never, yeah. Right.
Wow.
I never considered the significance. We are connected to music history.
Well, there you go.
In New Zealand.
So thank you for listening in today, everyone, and being a part of this, whatever this is. It's great to have you on board.
And big thanks to Gene Rivers.
Yes. And also thank you to you, Danny, for being such a great co-host. Oh. But also you do a lot of the editing. People won't know this, but behind the scenes, you do a lot of editing to put this stuff together. You work harder on it than I do. So
thank you. Thank you for saying that.
Yeah.
Thank you for co-hosting with me.
Oh, hey, my pleasure.
This is a love fest.
Love you later.
See ya.
If you find what we're doing useful and you like this podcast, please do like, share and subscribe and give us a review on iTunes.
It certainly looks like Ray's we're going to become a force user.
This is force user.
Wank wank talk. Eh? and
a
then,
force user. Did you just make up that term?
No, it's real. Like I said, it's all real. Look it up in the dictionary. I suspect that Finn is force sensitive and
force sensitive.
We're going to get mocked all the way through on this.
And
how old are you guys again?